WDRT is sponsored in part by Vernon Communications Cooperative, a local provider for internet, TV, and phone. Vernon Communications has been connecting communities and fostering progress for the past 73 years and is honored to be the area's hometown service provider. Learn more at vernoncom.coop.
Good morning. You are listening to WDRT Viroqua.
I wonder if we could begin by, you could explain where we are right now.
We're at a community conservation center in Berkeley, California.
It's a recycling place. Is it also a dump? No, it's not.
That's called the transfer station, also known as the dump, and that's down the street.
Okay, but they are dumping a lot of things. We just heard all of that glass.
They're dumping recyclables.
Recyclables,
okay. Not trash.
The evidence of our throwaway culture is all around us. It produces and it values a superabundance of stuff.
I'm going to look in some of these great big bins here. We have lots and lots of bottles. And the trucks are coming through, dumping out more things. Tin can, oh my goodness. Okay, those are more tin cans than I've seen in my entire life. Lots of glass.
Despite recycling, we still burn up prodigious amounts of natural resources to create more of everything. We also discard more of it.
Large appliances over here, old washers and stoves, washing machines, a half dozen of them. And that gentleman just threw out, looks like part of a computer.
Americans generate nearly 300 million tons of garbage a year. That's almost 5 pounds of trash per person per day. But hang on, this episode isn't a screed about how wasteful humans are, well, at least not directly. It's about how we got to this point, because humans weren't always materialistic. Our hominid ancestors were nomadic and carried what they needed with them. So how did we go from making do with what we need to accumulating what we don't? This is Big Picture Science from the SETI Institute, and I'm Seth Shostak.
I'm Molly Bentley. In this episode, how human evolution and the culture of more and more and more has led us to the wrong stuff.
Archaeologist Chip Caldwell remembers the very moment when he was stumped by the question of how humans went from needing hardly anything to their relentless accumulation of stuff.
I was visiting my sister in Seattle for the holidays, and she turned to me with what seemed to be a really simple question, which is, why do I have so much stuff? And I looked around her house, and it was like probably a lot of your listeners' houses. You know, it had tables and cups and plates and rugs and bookshelves filled with books and knickknacks. And I began to look around, and I felt like, as an anthropologist, an archaeologist, someone who spent years and years studying other people's stuff from ancient times, that I should have a pretty simple and straightforward answer. But I didn't. I really didn't. And she stumped me. And I started to look around and realize that no one had really offered a big theory of how our species went from millions of years ago, where we didn't need anything at all to survive except our bodies, to our world today, where we need everything. And it took me a number of years to find the answer. My name is Chip Caldwell, and I am the editor-in-chief of Sapiens.org, a digital magazine that translates the world of anthropology for the world. And I'm also an associate research professor at the University of Colorado, Denver.
So Much Stuff is the title of his book, How Humans Discovered Tools, Invented Meaning, and Made More of Everything. In it, Dr. Caldwell identifies three fundamental leaps in early human evolution that culminated in holiday shopping stampedes, storage lockers, and a throwaway culture. I mean, we've come a long way.
To answer the question of why do we have so much stuff, we must go to the beginning of our relationship with it. This is before cell phones and Air Jordans, before vacuum cleaners, air conditioners, hair conditioners, and refrigerators, before rotary phones, gramophones, and the Model T, before feathered hats, inkwells, gunpowder, and cans of baking powder, even before wax candles and papyrus. and before the materials we've used to make all of this: plastic, steel, concrete, rubber, nylon, silk, and oil.
We must return to the moment 3 million years ago when one of our hominid ancestors first realized that a rock could be made into a tool.
A lot of different animals actually use tools in really habitual ways. So, for example, there's a species of ants that uses mud and other kinds of materials of the world to transport honey. Birds, crows especially, have been observed to use different kinds of tools. So there is this deep animal instinct for tool use. But something really, really special happened about 3.5 million years ago in East Africa. And from what we can tell, a very ancient ancestor of ours in the genus of the Australopithecine figured out that stones could be used to cut apart meat.
So this was a stone tool that would basically act as a knife, right?
Exactly. Yeah, most likely they didn't hunt this animal, but rather it was a carcass that they were trying to salvage some of the food. So this ancient ancestor of ours probably figured out somehow, some way, that a stone tool could be sharpened, or a sharp stone tool could cut into the meat, could cut into long bones for marrow, and all of those calories could be more easily consumed. And that first cut really was the beginning point of this transformation of our species.
Let's linger on this just for a moment, because I think if we hear that, okay, our ancient ancestors used a rock essentially as a knife, that seems like a pretty straightforward creation. But you make the point that it was actually extraordinary because it required a big leap for early humans to see a rock as anything other than a rock. So could you give us an idea of where that leap took place? Was it a cognitive leap? Was it a physical leap in the hands? Help us understand just what it required for these early humans to fashion this first stone tool.
What's so special about this moment is that it was a triangulation of three different abilities. The first was physical ability, the ability to actually manipulate, you know, with one's hands, stones, and to break them apart in particular ways to sharpen them. So a physical ability was really important. Next is a working memory, the ability to remember a chain of actions that lead to a particular outcome. And in this case, you know, imagine you finally realize that a rock can be broken apart. You have a sharp edge. It cuts meat. It makes it easier to eat. But then next time you come across a carcass, do you actually remember those steps that it takes to get to that outcome? And a lot of our most ancient ancestors probably didn't have that ability, that working memory to remember all of that. So at this time, there is this working memory that comes into place at the same time the physical ability does. But then the last piece of the puzzle is what some scholars call learning with reason. And this is the ability to not just learn habitual actions, like those ants that can pile up mud to transport honey, but you have to reason. You have to have a creative tool use. You have to be able to creatively understand the problem and come up with a unique solution for it. And that is a major cognitive leap that you do not see in many parts of the animal kingdom.
So what you said is that we had an ancestor who first picked up this stone tool and unwittingly laid the path for the screwdrivers and the power saws that are sitting in our garages today, but it and the early tools that followed shaped our minds and bodies in return. How did that happen? What's an example?
Yeah, so the best way to think about a knife is to think about it as an external human tooth, right? So if you have a pile of raw meat and you need to eat it, it takes a lot of energy to actually consume that meat. You need sharp teeth, strong jaws. But if you're able to slice that meat prior to consuming it, you've started the digestive process external to your body. So when you're eating raw meat, instead of it being a big slab that you have to gnaw on and, you know, really get into smaller pieces to be able to swallow, if it's cut up into tiny little pieces like tartar, you're actually able to eat it more efficiently and easily, and you can actually get more calories out of it that way too. And so what happened is that as these technologies emerged for example, chopping up meat, chopping up root vegetables that were probably also very tough, the teeth of our ancient ancestors actually began to become duller. The jaws became smaller, more refined, because all of that eating started external to the body. And what that did in turn is allowed for more space in the head for bigger brains. At exactly the same time, our ancestors were consuming more calories more easily. So anthropologists use a little piece of jargon called techno-organic evolution. And it really is unique to our species, again, starting about 3.5 million years ago, where we co-evolve with our technology. And you begin to see this not just with cutting tools to eat food, but then later you begin to see it with shelter, for example, right? If you don't need to be exposed to the elements, we see the first houses emerge about 400,000 years ago. People start living in caves more efficiently. You see it with the emergence of clothing, right? If your skin, you don't need as much fur because you have clothing instead. So our bodies almost certainly began to evolve and change directly in response to the technologies that were created. And it explains why today we can't live without stuff. You know, we as a species are very susceptible to all kinds of dangers in the world, and we simply can't survive without these tools.
The point that you make about this tool, this first tool, and we're going to move on, but it's important to say one more thing about it, mm-hmm. is that it allowed us to go beyond our natural physical abilities. So now we could do some things that we weren't able to do. And as you write, this is a huge leap, but there's a continual feedback. So our bodies change because of our tools, but then our tools are reshaped too because of our biology. And this is a feedback that picks up speed.
Absolutely.
We become more tool-oriented and more dependent on tools.
Absolutely. And it's a really special, unique story, not to go too far into human exceptionalism, but what happened really is distinct in the history of evolution of, you know, within the animal kingdom, where there's this continuous feedback loop. And it is the really key part of that is the brain and the ability to have a bigger and bigger brain that because we're consuming more calories more easily because of these tools. But then as the brain gets bigger and more sophisticated, it in turn is able to make more sophisticated tools. So the bigger brain, the ability to problem solve in ever more creative ways because of the tools, then leads to more creative tools. And so that feedback loop is really dynamic and really a special part of our story.
One of the other concepts you describe that is key in understanding our attachment to tools is that of radical embodiment. And your description of this applies to all sorts of tools, eyeglasses and pencils and brooms, but it was about bikes that I identified strongly. And you write, quote, "When a person rides a bike, there is a beautiful unison when the person and the bike become part of the bike person machine." Chip, why is it that this idea of tools as an extension of our bodies is important as we consider the evolution and the attachment to stuff?
It's an important moment, and we don't know exactly where it happened and when, but we do know it happened somewhere in this story of our evolution, that as our bodies probably became more exposed to the world, more gracile, more feeble, you know, and unable to survive without these tools, the tools actually become an extension of our bodies themselves out into the world. So the examples we can draw from, people I'm sure are really familiar with this, you know, is think about you have a rake outside and you are raking and you come across some gravel. You could probably be blindfolded and know that you are raking across gravel, because we have evolved to be able to perceive the vibrations of that tool and interpret it in very particular ways. But our hand actually isn't touching the gravel, right? It's the tool that's touching it, and yet we can experience that. For musicians out in the world, think about a violinist playing a violin, and as she drags her bow across the string, she can precisely perceive the sounds that will emerge from it merely from the tool of the bow itself. And so it's the cognitive ability to actually extend ourselves out into the world through tools that allows us to use these tools in really powerful and creative ways. And so the bike example is yet one more of these where we, through balance, through perception of the vibrations of the wheels, the direction, that we actually become one with this instrument in the world.
As this happens with more and more tools, tools that are not something we have, they're almost something that we are. So here we are creating tools, we're attached to them, they allow us to do things that we weren't able to do. But you also make the point that the invention of things required the invention of other things. So if you have a hammer and you have a nail, then you need a claw. You need to invent the claw to take the nail out. And with everything that we make, we need to make other things to make everything possible. And it's an endless list of things that we needed to invent.
Yeah, that's fascinating, right? How an end product, an end thing, actually has many things that it takes to make that thing. And so, you know, way back, we can think about this in kind of simple terms. For example, it's cold outside and you need a coat, right? But to get a coat, you need an animal skin. Well, in order to get an animal skin, you need to kill the animal. So you need a sharp stone tool. Well, in order to make a sharp stone tool, you need a hammer, right? And so it kind of, as you're saying, you know, each step requires often more and more tools. And so that's just a coat made out of animal skins. Now imagine a computer, right, or an airplane or in our world today. And you can really understand how the technology, as it gets more and more complicated, you need actually more and more tools to create that end product.
It's interesting that you use the word need, because at some point, maybe it was want or desire, but now we use the word need. I need this. I need that. It's just assumed that we need to create more stuff and more iterations of things we already have. That word need creeps in at some point, where it used to be that it was maybe the need was confined to objects that had survival value. But yeah, maybe that definition of survival value has expanded as well.
Well, your question is creeping in a little bit to the conclusion of the book, but to preface it now, it's absolutely true. You know, if you think about probably the very start of some of the most basic technologies, like a coat to stay warm, that was a need. You know, probably as our species had these tools, they were actually able to move into new environments that otherwise they wouldn't be able to survive in. Right. So you actually see our ancestors move into very, very cold places that require these technologies. But without those technologies, they wouldn't have survived. So there probably was, you know, way back, some very basic needs tied to technology. And there still are today. Right. We need to eat, and we need often some level of technology in order to eat. But over the centuries, you're right that there's a slippage between need and want. And because of the Industrial Revolution, especially around marketing, in my view, we've become ever more convinced that wants are needs, when in fact they often are not.
Wonder why it's so hard to clean out your garage? Coming up, we identify the second leap in human evolution, the moment when we gave meaning to things.
You're listening to The Right Show About the Wrong Stuff on Big Picture Science.
If you feel like your house is overstuffed, well, there are studies to back you up. Anthropologist Chip Caldwell says that the average American home has 300,000 things. Okay, it would seem easy to part with a few thousand of them at least, but as we know, it can be difficult to say goodbye to just one.
And we can find insight into why that is if we jump from the birth of tools 3 million years ago, which we just heard about, to about 50,000 years ago, when our ancestors realized that things held the capacity to be more than objects of utility.
So this second leap in our discussion about the history of stuff is in some way the most important if we're to understand how we went from needing almost nothing to needing everything. In his book, So Much Stuff, Dr. Colwell defines this leap in human evolution as taking place when we began to imbue objects with symbolism and meaning.
So we're still piecing together when, where, and why exactly meaning was invented. But we see hints and whispers around the world of our ancient ancestors realizing that these tools can have an extraordinary ability to shape our perception of the world, our self-expression, our ability to recognize that something is beautiful, that something is spiritual, that something can be passed from generation to generation and have extra meaning in our lives. So as a counterfactual, if you could imagine, meaning never came along and we just stuck with tools merely for survival in the same way, you know, ants or crows or chimpanzees use tools, we wouldn't have our world today. Almost everything in our world today is built around the meanings they contain. And so without this leap, we wouldn't be who we are.
Now, you said tools are imbued with meaning, but something like your glitter cowboy boots or your antique books and things like that, those aren't tools per se. They're more like objects of art. So is this also the period of time when we begin to create things that they don't just have survival value, they don't just have utility? Because we wouldn't say that those blue cowboy boots, I don't know why I'm thinking of that, but any of the objects, look around, yeah. Most of them are not tools.
That is exactly what archaeologists are looking for, to try and define these first moments of meaning. So, for example, archaeologists found a shell that was processed, you know, for the meat within the shell, probably in Indonesia, dating to 500,000 years ago, made by a Homo erectus ancestor. And on this shell are carved these kind of zigzag marks into it. That's not a tool. There's no reason for a Homo erectus to carve into that shell, right? That's not going to help them eat better. It's not going to help them get more calories. So there was something in that moment where that Homo erectus ancestor thought to do something a little bit different with that shell that had no purpose for survival.
Do you interpret that as self-expression, if not art?
That's the mystery and the question. And, you know, from my viewpoint, yes, that is probably the first inkling of a version of self-expression. And it's fascinating that some of the earliest moments of proto-art, you know, self-expression, are these zigzags that we see. There's another artifact that I talk about in my book dating to about 100,000 years ago in South Africa, a large chunk of ochre, you know, the red mineral, that has very, very distinctive zigzags etched into them. And so those are the first hints that our ancestors are putting something different into these objects. And we know because of where we ended up today, somewhere between those very first etching marks and Van Gogh's Starry Night, we see the birth of art and meaning in its truest forms.
But Chip, the stuff, and I'm using the anthropological scientific term stuff because you use it in the title of your book, but the stuff we have around us, we couldn't make the case that all this stuff is all art. What is the connection between art and stuff, and when did it become stuff and not art?
Yeah, absolutely. And in the book, I suggest that art is just an example and probably one of the clearest examples that we have in the archaeological record of being able to trace the development of meaning. So it's not just art. We also see the emergence around this time of probably religious objects, probably about 100,000, definitely before about 50,000 years ago, we see religious objects emerge. You also probably see objects that have some sort of exchange value. For example, you see beads emerge about 50,000 years ago. So maybe the first hints of what eventually becomes money. Right. So it's this ability to have symbolic thinking and symbolic meaning in our world that is perhaps best traceable and best understandable in the form of art. But it's not just art. And that's what's so amazing, is that by about 50,000 years ago, we see meaning in its fullest forms all across the material world. And that is the foundation of our modern world and things of meaning.
But meaning is one thing. You could go back to that cave. The person who painted the bison 50,000 years ago might go and enjoy those paintings. But that's not the same as needing to acquire it. It's not the same as attachment. When did all of our stuff become infused with identity? Because at some point, it does become indistinguishable from identity and who we
are. That's right. That's right. And in order for that to happen, things have to have meaning, right? So for you to wear clothes and not just merely keep you warm, but express your identity as, you know, through gender, through nationality, through culture, through family history, all of those notions of identity, that comes through not just clothing as warmth, but clothing as meaning. So it's precisely the ability to attach meaning to objects, as we see in art as an example, that leads us to these fundamental connections that we make to things. And so that things aren't just merely tools, but that they are symbols of who we are, how we live, our values, our belief systems, things we love, things we loathe. All of that is tied to this invention of meaning.
That's very clear. So we are transmitting messages with everything that we buy and wear and own and share and give to other people. It's all imbued with meaning. But ownership and collecting things, this attachment to things, it doesn't have to be this way. Some cultures practice the custom of giving away objects. And you describe in the book the ritual around Native American potlatches. Can mm-hmm. you describe a potlatch, please? Mm-hmm.
So a potlatch is a cultural tradition practiced among a number of nations along the northwest coast of North America and Canada and the U.S. And in the tradition, a potlatch is held for lots of different reasons. Perhaps someone died. Perhaps someone is being honored. Perhaps there was an exchange of goods. So lots of reasons it happens. But essentially, it's a big party where people come together to celebrate whatever the event is. And a big part of this party is giving stuff away. And the more that you give away, the more prestige that the hosts have. And this event has really fascinated and captured many people's imaginations, and especially anthropologists who are trying to understand why people would give away so much stuff. You know, what's really the purpose in an evolutionary sense, in a cultural sense, of giving stuff away? Because it doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, most of us try to get as much as we can, accumulate as much as we have in order to demonstrate our wealth. But in this culture, giving stuff away is actually the way wealth and prestige are demonstrated.
So to review, objects begin to have symbolic meaning maybe 500,000 years ago, but at least 50,000 years ago with the birth of art. But then we come to this pivotal moment in this second leap, this leap where things become imbued with meaning. And that happens around 12,000 years ago. And up to this point, the accumulation of stuff has been held in check. And you write, throughout much of human history, the path to accumulate has been tempered by scarcity. People had access to little, so they could accumulate little. But then, Chip, we have the birth of agriculture, of staying in place. And how did that change our relationship to stuff?
It changed everything. So prior to about 12,000 years ago, in many parts of the world, people moved around a lot, and it was really hard to accumulate stuff when you had to move, you know, every so often, every season, or even more frequently. But when you settle down, as I think a lot of us probably know in our lives, right? The longer you are in a house, the more stuff you probably have there.
And the more that you need one more room. If yes. I just had one more room to put the stuff
right.
in,
and everything that's why you need a bigger house, just yes. to hold your stuff, right? So I think many of us realize this habit that we have of the once you're settled down, it's easy to accumulate stuff. And in a less joking way, once you're settled down, you actually need more stuff as well. You actually do need it, not just want it, because you need to be able to, for example, have ways of getting water into your town that's clean and being able to dispose of waste, right? So you need like sewer systems and plumbing and other kinds of technology and tools to build those systems. When you're settled in one place and you're defending it, you need an army, most likely, to be able to defend it. So now you need weapons and other kinds of systems in place for martial activities, and on it goes. So as people, our ancestors, settled in more permanent locations in order to cultivate foods, agriculture, we began to need more stuff in these settlements. And then a really key part of this, too, is the ability to have surplus. So if you have extra grain, if you have extra food, more cattle, you know, what do you do with that surplus? And then you have the emergence of inequalities that we see in our modern world as well, because individuals are able to use those surpluses to purchase more things, to have bigger palaces, to create priesthoods that have more kinds of religious objects that are in turn meant to navigate the vicissitudes of weather so that you have successful agriculture, right? So you have different classes and different kinds of specializations emerge in these societies, and with those inequalities, social inequalities, but material inequalities as well.
And those places where they stored their excess were probably the great ancestors of the modern day storage locker that we pay for.
Right.
Well, where did this quantity of stuff come from? Why am I able to stuff my garage to the gills with power tools and model trains? This next leap in human evolution paves the way for the modern era of abundance.
That's right. It's the wrong stuff on Big Picture Science. I'm walking down a shopping street in California, but this could be a street of shops anywhere in the country. And I'm just taking in the things that are for sale. We're looking at pants in four or five different colors, the same for sweaters, also hats. So hats in all different kind of colors and shoes. You have pumps and flats, boots and fancy shoes. And there's some beautiful shoes, actually. Those are great looking. Anyway, moving on. And around the corner here is a store of homewares. The selection of spatulas alone is impressive. So any spatula you need, any color you might want for your spatula is here on display. Red and white, blue, pink. So depends on your mood, I guess, when you're cooking.
The first two leaps in the history of stuff were cognitive. Humans figured out how to make tools and gave symbolic meaning to objects. The third and last leap into the modern age was cultural. That is, the drive and means to gather tons of raw material and turn them into goods through mass production. A recent study put global consumption of raw materials, you know, sand, clay, gravel, trees, coal, and oil, at 100 million tons a year. Anthropologist Chip Caldwell describes this shift in our cultural evolution that actually began a few centuries before the mass production of the Industrial Revolution. That's what created extreme abundance for billions of people and the rise of a throwaway society.
The seeds for our modern age of overconsumption are planted around 500 years ago, when we begin to see European global expansion, colonialism and imperialism, and the extraction of materials and minerals and other kinds of goods to produce an overabundance for an elite class in Europe. And through these global trade networks were put in place, that is what enabled the modern industrial world. as well as the beginning notions of an ideology of abundance, which is really, really key to this third leap. It's not just the ability to make more, it's the ability to want more and more and more and never feel like you have enough.
What's extraordinary about it is that it's been normalized. I mean, you're challenging it. Other scientists, other people are challenging this idea that more is better. But I'm wondering, as I hear you describe it now, the desire to have more and more and more, whether it's not a pathology. I mean, I guess it's an addiction, and that might make it a pathology.
Well, I'm not that kind of doctor, so I can't necessarily speak to pathologies. I can say, as an archaeologist, you see how our world today is a singular moment in Earth's history. In 4+ billion years, there has never been a species that has produced so much and that produces so much more than we could ever need.
You have a fascinating section on hoarding. And there's a twist to it, which we'll come to, which is its relationship to our throwaway culture. But could you give us an example of modern-day hoarding?
Mm-hmm. The most famous example, most fascinating example, is a story of two brothers who lived in New York. They're named the Collier Brothers. And they were hermits living in Harlem in New York. And they lived their lives, were kind of known in their neighborhood as strange people. They ended up passing, and their house was inspected by the police as they were trying to find the remains of the brothers. And what the police found was this 12-room mansion that was stuffed, literally, from floor almost to ceiling, the entire place. And there are thousands of tons of materials of just everything you could imagine from the modern age stuffed into this place. And that was the most famous case of modern hoarders. But there were other ones that have, even before then, that were talked about or known. But now today, with the easy ability to consume endless amounts of stuff, hoarding, unfortunately and tragically, has taken over many people's lives.
To put some of this in perspective, our ancestors would maybe bury a hoard, you know, have a hoard of tools or something else that they needed. But you distinguish between having a hoard and hoarding.
Yeah. Again, looking across the animal kingdom, you see many different animals practice hoarding behaviors. We see this, probably a lot of people notice squirrels hoarding food, right? There's this really amazing bird species called acorn woodpecker who hoards hundreds and hundreds of acorns in this kind of bank vault of acorns with all these holes that are tended with acorns in them for eating for later. So hoarding is not surprising that we have it as a human. It's smart. Often you want to save stuff for later. It helps you survive. But having a hoard to help you survive, or maybe you bury it for later because, you know, in the ancient world, you didn't have banks or storage facilities, that makes sense. But the hoarding that we see in our contemporary world is literally, this one is a pathology because psychologists have identified it as such, that it leads to distress. It leads to all kinds of limitations in people's ability to interact socially. It's an actual problem in our world, and it's made possible by the industrial complex that we have, where we can get a lot of stuff very quickly, very cheaply, and it can accumulate in ways that literally takes over people's lives.
The paradox and the twist is coming because we are both a hoarding and a throwaway society. Mm-hmm. But the moment that really made me sit up in your book, actually, there have been many moments, it's a great read, you write that hoarding and throwaway society are the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say a little bit more about that?
And so in the 1950s, on the heels of World War II, industrialists and marketers wanted to convince people to buy more. For one of the first times in human history, there was more surplus than demand because you had all these factories creating a lot of war material. So these factories had all the stuff, and they needed to convince people, as well as new technologies, especially plastics, that were invented and really refined during World War II. So they had the ability to make more and more stuff, and because there was a global depression, not a lot of people had a lot of money to buy stuff. So industrialists and marketers figured out that one way to get people to buy more was to convince people to throw away more. Meaning, instead of having one plate, a ceramic plate that you could use for a lifetime, you buy one plastic plate that you use once and then throw away immediately. And this was actually a very specific strategy laid out by capitalists to encourage us, all of us, to consume more and more and more.
But it doesn't stop at the plates, at the plastic that's meant to be thrown away. It's the toasters. I mean, the appliances in my parents' house lasted, I think, my entire childhood. Yeah. Maybe we got one new washing machine. Everything else was the same. We don't think about repairing things now, or a few people do. We are very comfortable with throwing them away and then getting something new.
And that is a marketing technique that has been used to convince us that it is okay. But it's also a technological approach called planned obsolescence. And that is a fancy word that basically means that a lot of things in our lives have been designed to go out of fashion very quickly, to break down very quickly, to not be repairable, so that we are compelled to buy more and more and more.
And those are different things. So one, if it breaks down, of course you have to get something new. But fashion, something going out of fashion is psychological, right? Because the dress may be perfectly fine to keep you warm or clothed.
Well, the 2 points, you know, on the first one, actually a lot of our electronics, for example, are repairable, but they're often built so that they cannot be repaired. Perhaps the battery, for example, that breaks down, that fails, is locked, literally designed to be locked into the back of the electronic, so you can't pry it open and simply replace the battery. Instead, you have to buy a whole new device. So a lot of our technologies actually are built to be thrown away as quickly as possible so that we're going to buy more and more. And then the second part of that is the design element and convincing us that to be a part of the latest fashions, we need to stay on top of the latest and greatest that's being offered to us. And that was invented by a car company, Chevrolet, back in the 1920s, when they realized that the cars were actually lasting people a long time, so they weren't buying them. And so they simply slapped on a new external body to the same interior of the car and sold it as quote-unquote new. And quote-unquote, literally superior, which was the name of some of those very first cars. And the idea was that this is a new something that's greater and better than the other thing, but the only difference was the shell of the car. And that describes so much of our notions of fast fashion, of the latest phones, and so much in our lives today.
And it has its origins in the origins of meaning and self-expression, that we're very attached to self-expression and what that telegraphs. I found it interesting to learn that the term planned obsolescence, which I thought arose around the time of the iPhone, actually goes all the way back to the 1930s.
That's right. That's right. Marketers figured this out pretty early. And I love your point about how deftly marketers and others have tapped in to this very ancient and fundamental notion of what it is to be human and our love of meaning. That's such an important point.
So just to be clear of why a hoarding society is also a throwaway society, if you walk into someone's house who is a hoarder, you've probably owned all that stuff yourself.
Exactly.
But now that stuff is sitting in a landfill or in a garbage can somewhere.
Exactly, yeah. And I was myself shocked when I looked at the numbers, and you know, you can look at, you know, hoarders' homes that have been cleared out and the actual tonnage that is in the home, and you look at the average waste of an average American and how much they throw in a landfill, and they're not that far apart. They're really close. And so that's exactly it. We are all hoarders. It's just we hoard our stuff in landfills, and it's out of sight and out of mind, and we think we can live simply, or, you know, ways that aren't over consuming, but we're hoarding often at vast scales that are damaging to, I would argue, ourselves in many ways, our communities, and the environment writ large.
And that brings us to the final big picture point here. So we've come to this point where we have created, we've manufactured, as it were, this ideology of consumption. We have an insatiable desire for more stuff, as you said. And Chip, I wonder if you could describe where that has left us. That is, psychically, culturally, and what the environmental consequences are.
The consequences are very real. It's estimated, for example, that the amount of waste the world will throw away is almost going to double by 2050. We can look at the amount of plastics in our oceans. We can look at the kind of harms that our teenagers are experiencing. As the father of a 12-year-old, I'm really tapped into this notion that you can only be beautiful if you buy this makeup or these clothes, that you can only be happy if you have a big house. You know, those are dangerous notions, even at the individual personal level of how we live our lives and our notions of identity. So from the smallest, most intimate part of our lives to the biggest parts of our world and what we need to sustain our lives, the story of stuff has led us to the precipice of a question of whether or not, you know, we're really going to be able to survive and sustain this world that we've created through our things.
Well, finally, Chip, I know that historians don't like to play the game of what if, engage in the speculation of the past. I'm sure that anthropologists, archaeologists are the same. But if you could meet the individual who led us down this evolutionary and cultural path when he or she picked up that first rock, or if you could have halted the evolution of stuff somewhere along that 3 million year trajectory, would you have stopped it 3 million years ago, or is there an ideal resting point along the way between having and resisting stuff? Where would that be?
Wow, that's such a good question. You know, it's hard to imagine who we are in every sense. You know, the way we perceive the world, the way we exist, the way we survive, the things that bring us joy, the things that bring us pain, all of that is tied to this history of stuff. So to go back and stop that very first Australopithecine from, you know, slicing off a piece of meat with a stone tool, I think would be asking for us not to exist. So I'm not sure I would go that far. but I do think, you know, one of the most fundamental turning points was certainly during the Industrial Revolution and the emergence of capitalism, which is predicated on the notion of abundance and needing to produce more and more and consume more and more. And I think in that, it's really in that third leap where we see very specific choices being made that led us to our world of overconsumption. And to me, what's so encouraging about that is this is not some, you know, I'm not, I think, pointing back to 3 million years ago. This is within recent, relatively recent history. And these are choices that we can make, and these are choices that we can still make. We can reevaluate, we can reimagine our world of stuff in totally new and radical ways.
Well, Chip Caldwell, thank you so much for this illuminating exploration of our relationship to stuff.
Thank you.
Chip Caldwell is an archaeologist and former curator of anthropology at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science. He's editor-in-chief of the digital magazine Sapiens and author of So Much Stuff: How Humans Discovered Tools, Invented Meaning, and Made More of Everything.
Well, Seth, we've come to the big picture moment in this show about the evolution of stuff, how we went from primates that needed very little to compulsive shoppers that need just about everything. What are your big picture thoughts here?
Yeah, I think that those early humans, I mean, you know, the people that were walking around 10,000 years ago or 20,000 years ago, they didn't need too much. They needed to secure their next meal. They needed to protect themselves. They needed a mate. But beyond that, you know, they weren't so much into getting a fancy new car or anything like that. And as technology has proliferated, the number of items we could have, well, maybe it's just our inner nature. Maybe it's something we can't avoid, but we want some of that stuff.
That's true. We do. And George Carlin agreed.
You know how important that is. That's the whole meaning of life, isn't it? Trying to find a place for your stuff. That's all your house is. Your house is just a place for your stuff. If you didn't have so much stuff, you wouldn't need a house. You could just walk around all the time. That's all your house is. It's a place to keep your stuff while you go out and get more stuff.
This show is assembled thanks to the right stuff of senior producer Gary Niederhoff and assistant producers Brian Edwards and Shannon Rose Geary. I am the executive producer of Big Picture Science, Molly Bentley.
Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, a nonprofit education and research organization that searches for life beyond Earth. I'm the Institute's senior astronomer, Seth Shostak. Also, a big thanks to our listeners and our Patreon supporters.
The original music in the show is by Dewey DeLay and June Miyake. This episode of Big Picture Science that looks at the history of how we came to accumulate far more than we need is called The Wrong Stuff.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leiserwitz, and this is Climate Connections. People use warm water for everything from scrubbing dishes to relaxing in the bath, so water heaters are one of the biggest energy draws in a home. But with the latest technology, you can get hot water while saving on your utility bills. Wesley Whited of DNV, a global consulting firm, says new electric heat pump water heaters operate more efficiently than standard electric resistance models.
They're removing heat from the air and transferring it into the water instead of directly heating an element, which is the way we've historically always heated our hot water.
He says they're most attractive to people who live in the Pacific Northwest and California, where hot water is already typically heated with electricity instead of natural gas.
It's a lot easier when you already have an electric resistance water heater to move to a heat pump water heater because you have the circuiting in place.
The devices do have a higher upfront cost, but there are often rebates and incentives available for buyers, and homeowners can expect to save money over time. According to the EPA, switching to a heat pump water heater that is ENERGY STAR certified can save a family of four more than $500 each year. And by reducing your home's energy use, you'll help the climate, too. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Yeah. Ed Hollihan here with a friendly reminder to support your favorite community radio station during our one-day spring pledge drive on Wednesday, May 7th. We'll be kicking off the day with a generous $1,000 cash match from Socially Responsible Retirement Strategies. Plus, everybody who donates will be entered to win a pair of tickets to a show of their choice at Viroqua's Historic Temple Theater. So tune in and show your love for the station by making a pledge. You can call 608-683-8937 or go to wdrt.org/donate. It all starts at 6 a.m. Wednesday, May 7th. Join us, won't you?
Support for WDRT comes from Westby Cooperative Creamery, a farmer-owned cooperative since 1903, offering dairy products, including Westby organic brand products, along with cheese trays, gift boxes, and more. Available at their cheese and gift store in downtown Westby and online at westbycreamery.com.
WDRT is sponsored in part by the Small Family Farm and CSA, offering weekly and biweekly CSA shares of local, seasonal, and organic vegetables. Small Family Farm also offers on-farm worker shares. More information at smallfamilycsa.com.
Good morning. You are listening to 91.9 FM, WDRT Viroqua, Driftless Community Radio.
Welcome to the WDRT Community Calendar, a listing of local events to be held the week ending Sunday, May 11th. On Tuesday, May 6th, the McIntosh Memorial Library will hold a hands-on educational experience with Beth Summers, Executive Director of Valley Stewardship Network, at 5:30 p.m. Using the Enviroscape model, Beth will demonstrate how different land uses affect water quality and explore practical solutions to protect our waterways. For more information, visit McIntoshMemorialLibrary.org. On Wednesday, May 7th, the Aging and Disability Resource Center of Vernon County hosts the 4th Annual Vernon County Senior Fair from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Vernon Memorial Building, located on the Vernon County Fairgrounds. The event will offer door prizes, bingo, live music, transportation, blood pressure checks, and more. More details available at ADRC of Vernon County, 608-637-5201. Also on Wednesday, the McIntosh Memorial Library will host a class on understanding online health services at 10 a.m. The attendees will receive basic information on how to access reliable sources for health information and how to avoid potentially harmful information. Registration is required and can be done by visiting www.mcintoshmemoriallibrary.org. On Thursday, May 8th, Open Doors Forum presents DIY Family-Directed Home Funerals at 7 p.m. in the chapel of Viroqua United Methodist Church. Learn about green or natural burial and how it differs from conventional burial. For more information, call 608-637-3551. On Saturday, May 10th, the Ridgetones Spring Concert will be held at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Viroqua at 7:30 p.m. Also on Saturday, the spring foraging in the Driftless will take place from 9 a.m.